you've just removed the blood supply from the gut. Mm-hmm. So how the heck is it going to digest a bunch of starch or oats or something like that?
Welcome to the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. So together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now, here's your host, Tina Muir.
Hello, this is Tina Muir. Thank you so much for being here with me today for the latest episode of the Run to the Top podcast, brought to you by runnersconnect.net. So last week, we talked to Jason Karp, who talked about his book called The Inner Runner. I know that book would have appealed to a lot of you, well, actually, probably most of you listening. And I myself got to see some benefits that I hadn't even realized, and I'm sure you will too. And if you haven't got that book already, and you haven't listened to that podcast already, I really would recommend going back to listen, especially if you do love running more than just the PRs and the weight loss. So, on to today. Have you ever felt exhausted in your training and your life, really? You know, so tired that you can barely finish your runs, but we're such stubborn runners that we don't want to back away from them. We don't want to take a day off. And you know you're not overtrained, but you just get that inner feeling that something is wrong. Well, I know I had that feeling, and actually today we may have the answer for you. Okay, it might not be the answer as such, but the steps you can take to get your answer. So I really would recommend you keeping going and checking this out. I've been working with Chris Kelly of Nourish Balance Thrive for a few months now, and it's been incredibly insightful to hear from him about how he's helping people all over the world to feel good. And not just feel good for the temporary, for the next, you know, day or two or year or two, but their long-term health. And although we talk a lot about athletes today, this isn't just for athletes. We're talking mostly about those health problems we tend to push aside and tell ourselves, oh, you know, that's just normal. Well, Chris made me, and hopefully will make you consider getting those taken care of, because it really could change your life for the better. We do dive into the science a little more than usual today, but I'm sure my guests won't mind me saying it can be a little bit overwhelming. However, I will say that this could unlock a lot of mystery for your life. It definitely has in mine, and I am encouraging you to stick with it. So if you're ready to meet Chris, after a quick word from our sponsor, we'll be ready to go.
Multiple studies have proven running with music helps to improve performance. I have become addicted to my Jabra Pulse sport headphones, using them for almost every easy run, but shh, don't tell my coach. You will love these earbuds too, and you can enter to win a free set every month by visiting jabra.com/runnersconnect.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to be talking to another English person. I feel like I don't get enough of this. And especially as you are a transplant living in America, this is kind of cool.
Yeah, we do have a lot in common.
Yeah, we do. So, okay, I want to hear a bit about you, as people will obviously now know you are from England, but you do live in America. But you want to tell us a bit about your background. You know, you were a pro mountain biker, you know, where you kind of started, how you ended up here, just a few tidbits on your life.
Sure. I have to be very careful. When you say pro mountain biker, people get very defensive of that term.
And okay.
I do have a UCI pro license, but I'm what most people would call a hobby pro.
Okay.
So nobody's paying me a salary to ride my bike. I don't even get any free stuff. But I did have to beat all the other amateurs in order to get that license. So,
is it
does
like
mean
triathlon?
Something.
Like where you get your pro card, or I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I've never...
Okay. Yeah, so I did have to, so I had to send them my results, and then I had to pay a fee, and then they sent me a license. And then if I want to race in the age groups again, then I have to downgrade officially.
Okay. Oh, okay. I never really knew this, because running is just running, you know, you just enter a race and you're done. So this is interesting to learn.
Yeah. So mountain biking is like that too, that, you know, more and more of the races are not sanctioned because I don't think the USAC have done a very good job of organizing bike racing, right? And people are starting to become disgruntled, and it costs a lot of money to become USAC sanctioned. So yeah, more and more of the races are just, you just turn up and just race whatever you want, and nobody, self-selected, right, the category.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so your journey, you know, what we're going to talk about today kind of began with you noticing some, you know, health problems, your health was deteriorating, and do you want to kind of tell us a bit about what was going on and why you decided to just
you know, do something about it rather than ignore it like most people.
Sure. Well, I got to the point where I really couldn't ignore it.
Oh.
But that was the big hairy aspirational goal, was to get that piece of cardboard, right? To have the USAC make it possible for me to never win another bike race, right? To get that pro license. And I guess it all started when I first moved to the US. I was brought here by Yahoo, and I'm a computer programmer. I have an undergraduate degree in computer science. And when I moved to the US, I suddenly had so much more motivation to get outside and ride my bike. I'd always ridden my bike, you know, in the UK, but here it seems like everybody has a road bike. And tons of people. This is the birthplace of mountain biking. I live in Santa Cruz, and the trails are world class, and everybody rides tons. And, you know, one day someone said to me, hey, you're pretty fast and you should come to a bike race with me. I think you do quite well. And I did, and they were right. And so I got quite serious about it. And my idea of serious was riding my bike to work as fast as I possibly could every day. And of course, that didn't work very well. In fact, it worked very well in the beginning, but you know, 3 weeks later, I was super duper tired. So that was a mistake. And so I got a coach, and the first thing he did was got me to slow down. And that was very, very helpful. But at the same time, as the volume increased, you know, I got up to maybe a peak of 21 hours a week of training, was quickly upgrading to Cat 1, which is the highest amateur category before pro. And my health just continued to get worse and worse. And so by health, I mean insomnia and fatigue, like not normal training fatigue, like terrible fatigue, to where I couldn't really do my job at work and I didn't have a social life. And the only thing I could really do was train. For some reason, I always managed to find the energy to go out and do a 3-hour bike ride, but there was no way that I could go out and meet somebody for a drink after work, say. Like, that was absolutely unfathomable to me. And then super low sex drive, so absolutely zero interest in women, which is not great, obviously, for any man at any time, but particularly so for a guy in his early 30s that's just moved from London to the Silicon Valley Bay Area. So that kind of sucked. And, you know, a lot of GI symptoms as well. So a lot of gas, a lot of bloating, a lot of diarrhea. And I didn't even really know what normal digestion was at that time. Mm-hmm. I really didn't. Like, looking back on that, I just didn't know. And I did what anyone would do. And I went to the doctor, to my primary care doctor. And by the time things came to a head and I did that, I was working for a hedge fund in Walnut Creek. And they prided themselves on the healthcare that they provided. So, you know, I had really good PPO health insurance. And so I went to the doctor and he was just worse than useless. Really, really useless. And he sent me to a gastroenterologist. And the gastroenterologist was worse than useless. And she was not interested in the food that I was eating at all, and said that I had inflammatory bowel syndrome, which is not a diagnosis. I'm sorry, it's not. It's just telling you what you told them. And that I could take some steroid anti-inflammatory drugs. And when those stopped working, then there would be surgery for me. And at about that same time, I met the woman who is now my wife. And she had just finished a master's degree in food science and had chosen not to go down the route of becoming a registered dietitian or a nutritionist, because she thought that what she would have to practice, especially if she were to work for a government-funded institution, would not help people. And she said to me, oh, well, your gastroenterologist is an idiot and you should fire them and you should try eliminating some of the common food allergens before you go any further.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd already kind of figured out, like, just before I met her, I read The Paleo Diet for Athletes by Joe Friel and Lauren Cordain. And so I was kind of onto the solution already. And she helped me decide that I should try to do something called the Autoimmune Paleo Protocol, which is a small caveat in Rob Wolf's The Paleo Solution book, and was popularized by Sarah Ballantyne, who's a PhD medical researcher. And since then, a number of other experts have written some really good books on the autoimmune paleo diet. And that worked spectacularly well for me, not just in the way that I felt, but also in my blood chemistry. I saw a huge reduction in the inflammation markers and I just felt so much better. And that really got my wheels turning, you know, that kind of whet my appetite for feeling good. It's very addictive, feeling good. Mm-hmm. And I listened to a lot of podcasts already and I just really developed this voracious appetite for the podcasts, and eventually found my way to functional medicine and thought, well, heck yeah, you know, what else is going on? You know, like, why did this AIP thing work so well? Let's do some testing. And so I worked with a functional medicine practitioner that ran some tests on me And they found all kinds of other problems. They found a pinworm gut infection. They found an amoebic infection. They found yeast overgrowth. They found multiple nutritional deficiencies. They found hormone imbalances, all kinds of problems that, you know, maybe sound a little bit scary. But the cool thing about this thing is that it's not the same as when you go to the doctor and you get a diagnosis of something terrible. This is subclinical, right? So this is something you can fix quite easily with nutritional supplements. And when you do, you feel so much better. And of course, when you feel so much better and you're so much healthier and you're not walking around with a bunch of bugs and parasites, then that allowed me to really recover so much faster and get to the point where I was able to get that pro upgrade. And yeah, I was just so excited by the whole thing. I decided to quit my job at the hedge fund and start a functional medicine practice for myself. I did a whole bunch of training, Dan Kalish's functional medicine course, and then I've done others too, courses in physiology and biochemistry. And then, of course, my wife's a food scientist, so she already had most of the education. And I'm partnered with a medical doctor who's also a pro mountain biker, and another medical doctor, Tommy Wood, who's been on the Endurance Planet podcast several times. He's an amazing guy. And I employ a registered nurse who's also functional medicine trained as well. So yeah, Nourish, Balance, Thrive is our business. And we've, in the last 2 years, we've tested 700 athletes and we've been getting the same great results that I got with very, very similar techniques. So super excited. I'm so excited about everything I do at the moment. It's all so much fun.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what you want from a job and from a life. And, you know, and like you said, it's kind of like a cycle that keeps feeding into itself. The better you feel, the better you want to look after yourself, and you kind of keep getting more and more. So you said Nourish, Balance, Thrive. You've obviously mentioned you kind of built yourself a little team around you. So for those people who don't, you know what it is or haven't heard of it, which I'm sure a lot of people haven't who are runners, because I don't know how many runners you've worked with, but probably I wouldn't say that many would have been up to date with this. So what is it? And kind of give us some background.
The program.
Yep.
Yeah, the program. So actually, we work with a lot of runners.
Oh, okay.
The mountain bikers tend to be less serious, I would say. They're more kind of happy-go-lucky, just here for fun type guys. And the triathletes tend to be much, much more serious. So with triathlon, obviously, you're doing three sports at once. And I think you have to be serious in order to pull that off. And certainly you have to be serious and very well organized if you want to pull it off and retain your health. I think that's quite a tricky thing to do. So yeah, I guess most of the people we work with are actually runners. And then some people are just runners, just dedicated to running and nothing else. And the program that we do, I would say it's mostly diet and lifestyle based. So we make some specific recommendations with people's diet. And it's my wife who coached me, does that work. And we also do lifestyle coaching. And that lifestyle coaching has been the culmination of me interviewing about 130 experts for my podcast. And I've transcribed every single word that's been said. I have well over a million words of transcripts. And, you know, that's been kind of fun for me to try and unpick, you know, that functional medicine was handed to me as a black box. And I really, really wanted to know how it worked, which is typical for me being a computer guy, right? Like, I really want to know mechanisms really interest me. So yeah, I've been doing the podcast, understanding what makes people feel good, what works for performance and longevity, and then turning that into a list of tasks that people can do. And then I use a system of project management from the software engineering world called Agile, where we use a Kanban board to organize to-do lists to get people to do what we call a sprint. So this is a 2-week period where you get shit done. And then we go around in iterations, because most people, you can't cope with everything at once, right? I can't give you a million words of transcript and say, hey, just read all this, you'll be fine, right? We have to break this down and prioritize and work in iterations and sprints. So yeah, that's I think, where most of the benefit comes from. But beyond that, we do blood chemistry and then also urinary organic acids and hormones and then also stool testing. And we're looking for the same types of problems that I found on my test results. And we treat them in very, very similar ways. And it's amazing. I mean, obviously, most people that come forward to us, they have some specific complaints that they're dealing with. And the rates at which we find problems are just extraordinary. Now, if you do an organic acids test with 75 markers on it, you're going to find something you can correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that when you correct those problems, people feel better, they sleep better, they perform better. Life is just a kind of a more fun experience. So yeah it's just incredibly uplifting to do, you know, the follow-up calls, the third or fourth call where you go through stuff with people and they're starting to feel so much better. It's just the most amazing experience. And I have so much fun doing that work.
And then so the kind of people that you, you know, you're talking to right now, the kind of people you have been working with and would like to work with more in the future, what kind of symptoms you mentioned, you know, lack of sleep or like not feeling great, but what things maybe people listening right now that maybe they didn't pay attention to before now that they could be thinking, actually, I do have that. And then maybe I should get this, you know, checked out, get some of these markers taken care of.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to stress that, you know, if you're okay, you're okay. Like, I don't really want to be putting fear into people and making them believe that there's something wrong with them when there really isn't. But having said that, I can tell you that symptoms are a pretty lousy way to assess what's going on inside your body. You know, you look at the symptoms of just about every disease known to man, and the main thing is fatigue, right? Everything makes you feel tired. So knowing that you feel tired, that literally could be anything.
Mm.
And so you really have to do some testing to try and know what's causing that fatigue. So fatigue, I would say, is the main thing. And for athletes specifically, you know, when I cast my mind back to how I felt when I was going through this, I'd really lost my appetite to train. You know, I was getting it done. I would get out there and do it, you know, even 3 or 4 hour rides, and I'd still get it done. But I just didn't look forward to it. You know, I just wouldn't be motivated, I would say. I'd really lost my motivation. And with it, there was a kind of mild depression, you know, that kind of overtraining syndrome. But I wasn't overtraining, and like, I had a really solid plan, and still I was having these symptoms. And so you're tired, and at the same time, you're not sleeping well, right? So you feel like you can sleep at any time during the day, but not very well at night. And that really sucks, because when you sleep at night, that's when all the growth hormone and the testosterone and all the good stuff happens, and that's when you get faster. So once you stop sleeping, you're in a difficult spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could definitely see that, and you know, our listeners know that I have gone through, you know, some bouts of insomnia myself, and it's nothing fun. And I'm guessing, you know, what you were saying, it's probably almost you were kind of just in a habit of exercising and kind of didn't. It was more that you just didn't want to stop than you actually wanted to do it. Was that right? What, during that time, like someone listening right now who may be kind of in that same boat, like the passion's gone, even though maybe like in your case, it wasn't the passion, but it feels like the passion is gone and you're just kind of doing it, like going through the motions.
Yeah, exactly. You've been handed a training plan, and as an athlete, probably a type A individual, almost by definition, right? Like if you like want to race, then that makes you a type A, doesn't it? I would say.
Yeah.
And so the training plan is just something you're checking the boxes, just getting it done. But it's not all about that, right? I mean, you should love what you do. I'm not, you know, one of the things I've discovered through the podcast and working with Tommy is that there's a U-shaped curve to exercise, and marathon running and long distance mountain bike races is probably not what you want to do if your goal is performance. Sorry, is specifically longevity.
Mm-hmm.
And so you should be doing this because you love it. And certainly I ride my bike now because I love it, particularly the mountain bike. And you shouldn't be doing it just because you have a plan or just because you want to finish a race, I don't think. You should have intrinsic motivation for what you do.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, I actually a few years ago was even at the point where when people would say to me, why do you run? I'd say, well, because I like the feeling when I run a PR at the finish line. And looking back now, like that's, you should never just have that as your primary motivator, because, you know, PRs like that are so fleeting and so rare that, you know, you need other reasons to enjoy it. And mm-hmm. It's interesting that maybe it isn't even so much emotional and mental, but it's, you know, the way we're doing in general through our body and what's going on with it. Okay. So, you know, someone listening who's kind of getting a bit curious about this and thinking that maybe this is something that they are interested in. You mentioned about the different tests you do, the organic acid, the stool testing, the Dutch, which we're going to go on to talk about in a minute.
Why is it that these tests are so much better than, you know, the getting a saliva test or, you know, getting just blood work from your doctor? What kind of makes these kind of take that next level?
I would say, well, blood chemistry is useful. So, you know, if you can, if you've got the kind of GP that doesn't mind ordering you blood chemistry, do it. You know, if your insurance will cover it. And it's useful to track progress over time to see which direction you're headed. Like blood chemistry is ubiquitous and it's very well understood. Excuse me. So it's great to have that data to be able to track your progress. You know, if you're seeing your inflammatory markers like hsCRP going in the wrong direction over time, or maybe your fasting blood glucose is creeping up or your fasting insulin is creeping up, then I think it's important to know that. But the thing about blood chemistry and most of the testing that your conventional doctor will do is they don't really tell you why. Right. So when I see elevated fasting blood glucose on a blood chemistry, I'm thinking, why? Why is this happening? Like, this is not right. You should have a very insulin sensitive endurance athlete that's disposing of tons of glucose. They should be sucking this stuff right up. And this is something's going wrong here. And you know, so why? And the other types of testing that we do, I think they do a really good job of answering that question. Why? What's going on here? Like, is it yeast overgrowth? Is it some kind of infection? Is it a nutrient deficiency? Because all of those things, they can cause that problem that you've seen on the blood chemistry, which is elevated fasting blood glucose. So, you know, I'm just a problem solver. I feel like I was a problem solver when I worked for a hedge fund, and I'm still a problem solver now. It's just that rather than working with the back end of, you know, some computer system with the Python programming language, I'm now using these tests to try and figure out what's going on inside someone's body and doing the same types of problem solving.
Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing a lot of these markers that, you know, maybe a little bit out within just a regular, you know, blood work, these are the kind of things that, yeah, they may be fine now, but, you know, fast forward a few years, you know, a lot of our listeners are kind of in the master's age group. These are the kind of ages where things do start to break down. Maybe it's, you know, 10 years down the road where you have problems, but if you get it taken care of now, then it's not going to be so big of an issue. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, excuse me. When you look at, say, type 2 diabetes or anything associated with insulin resistance, you know, the diagnosis may come in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, but I don't think anyone would deny that the signs were there from probably quite a young age, you know. So insulin resistance starts young, and there may be something you can pick up in the blood chemistry and address that early on before you get to the point where you're starting to see, you know, damage to your kidneys or damage to your eyes or something else. Like, you don't want to wait for that type of disease diagnosis. You want to get on top of it and then maybe change your diet and lifestyle and address those things before it's a proper disease and a problem.
Mm-hmm. And what about people who kind of say, you know, maybe older, maybe younger, say, well, you know, I run so I can kind of get away with anything. I honestly used to have that attitude until maybe a year or two ago, but I'm sure quite a few people listening still do.
Yeah, no, I just totally agree, because there's just so many examples of people that are athletic, but still run into these types of problems, particularly with insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. And I would fall into that category. You know, when I was feeding at my worst, I checked my blood glucose for the first time and my fasting value was 120 milligrams per deciliter, which technically is diabetes. It's not good at all. And then there are other examples too, like Steve Redgrave, the British rower, was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes before he won his last gold medal, right? So this is
he won
guy
five, right? Just for American listeners.
Right, five, yeah, like, yeah. One of the five is he goals. The most successful Olympian of all time?
I think time? So, yeah. Well,
yeah,
as far
so,
as I know.
Yeah, so absolutely amazing. So it's not a free pass. Just because you're an athlete, it doesn't mean that you're immune to, you know, these types of diseases that most people associate with obesity.
Yeah, and then what about you mentioned earlier that, you know, you were kind of turned on to digestion and how initially you didn't really know what normal digestion was. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of runners out there listening, you know, have had bad experiences with stomach upsets. And you mentioned, you know, you do the stool testing, which obviously is going to mean that you have quite great deal of expertise in this area, even though it's not necessarily you looking at it. But what kind of stomach upset or GI issues should runners kind of pay attention to and not just kind of brush off as, oh, you know, I just get an upset stomach every time I run, so, oh, well, I just get on with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's normal physiology. So if you're wondering if you're the only runner on the planet that's ever had GI symptoms from running, stop worrying, because it's literally everyone. And yeah, there's multiple studies that show this, that, you know, up to 92% of runners have GI distress, particularly during racing, right, when you're going particularly hard. And that is normal exercise physiology. So there are receptors in the gut for adrenaline, and the purpose is to shut off the blood supply to the gut and to divert the blood to the exercising muscles. And this creates what's called an ischemic injury. So the removal of the blood supply creates an ischemic injury to the gut. And once you have this ischemic injury, you can see a translocation. So that's just a fancy word for the stuff that's inside of your gut moving across the gut lining and into the bloodstream. And those things like lipopolysaccharides, which are part of the lining, that the cell membrane of gram-negative bacteria. And these are what called endotoxins. So these can make you insulin resistant, actually. And so they translocate across the gut membrane when you exercise. And that's totally normal. And there's not really that much you can do to avoid that. So that's something that I think happens to all runners. And I think runners are particularly badly affected. You know, on the bike, there's not quite so much jostling as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just spinning fairly constant circles with respect to running, where you're constantly being pounded. So the runners do quite badly. But I think it should go away quite quickly after you stop exercising. So if you're still getting diarrhea, you know, even like all the time, even when you take a week off, and you need to Google the Bristol stool chart and have a look and see, like, number 4 is normal, I believe. And I think there's kind of an epidemic of people that don't really know what a normal poop looks like. And so it might be a useful exercise just to do that and just to check that you are normal. Because I certainly didn't know, like, back, you know, a few years ago when I went through this, I didn't even know. So, yeah, so normal exercise physiology creates problems with the gut. But then beyond that, you know, we see a lot of runners that are walking around with a yeast overgrowth, or maybe they've got a parasitic infection like Blastocystis hominis or Cryptosporidium or H. pylori. And these are really common infections that don't cause problems for everyone, but do cause problems for some people, particularly people who are under a lot of stress. And I would classify running, especially if you're doing sort of marathon type distances, as being a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. So you may be more likely to succumb to problems caused by these bugs.
Okay. And then, so you said it's, you know, pretty normal for people to, you know, experience GI distress. But is there some kind of, you know, if you get it every time you run, or if you get it when you're not running hard, or, you know, if it's causing you to stop running, you know, to go more than, you know, once every half an hour, is there some kind of way that you should... people should listen and say, okay, you know, there's GI distress and there's what I'm getting, which is way more. This is when I need to do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's when it's just chronic and ongoing. So obviously there's going to be a kind of a dose response type curve. So I said it was adrenaline that was the neurotransmitter that makes the changes in the gut and shuts off the blood supply. So you're obviously going to see a much worse response when you're in a race and you're running super hard than when you're just out for an easy run and, say, your heart rate doesn't go above 140 BPM or something. And, you know, you're chatting with your mates and what have you. So that's obviously not going to be as stressful as something with higher intensity.
Okay. And is there anything else that people need to be aware of when it comes to this, or is that kind of just trust your body and allow it to calm down? And, you know, I know a lot of us get stomach upsets after the race, not so much during. Is that normal as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So there can be reperfusion injuries, and that's just a fancy way of saying when the blood supply is reconnected to the gut, then you can see damage done to the blood vessels. Because you can imagine it, like, so you've taken away the blood supply, to a certain extent and everything's empty, mm-hmm. and then you open the floodgates and the blood rushes in, and that the pressure of that reperfusion can actually cause an injury. But I think, you know, this situation is made worse by the crap that people eat when they try and run, right? So, you know, you're probably, as an elite runner, you're probably not one of these people that eats a ton of food when you do even a 2 or 3 hour run. But certainly I do see that, especially on the mountain bike, is where I see guys normally. You know, they're out for just a 1 hour ride and they're choking down a bunch of Clif bars and gels and God knows what else. And remember, I've just told you that you've just removed the blood supply from the gut. Mm-hmm. So how the heck is it going to digest a bunch of starch or oats or something like that when without a blood supply? So simple carbohydrates, and if you're just tipping glucose down there, that's good, basically just going to diffuse across the gut without too much trouble. But if you try eating too much more than that, then, you know, I think that could be a recipe for disaster.
Yep, very true. And unfortunately, a lot of the time after a big race like a marathon, I'm gonna overindulge, and my stomach's definitely not very happy for a while after that. But I allow myself to have whatever I want at that point. But otherwise, that kind of makes you think about it a little bit more. Yeah, no, probably not making you happy here.
it's everybody does it. The mountain bikers are particularly bad about it. You know, there's the taco truck at the end of the race, and everybody wants to drink beer.
I don't know if I'd want
tacos. Oof. Yeah, exactly. So everybody wants to drink beer and celebrate after the end of the race. And that's great. No, I kind of agree with that. It's kind of fun. But it's actually the worst possible time for you to indulge in that stuff. You'd be much better off having a beer and a burrito on the day that you're not racing, right? Because your gut's in much better shape to handle that type of burden than immediately after a race. And, you know, I found that, you know, I've been able to reintroduce a lot of the foods that I took out when I went onto the autoimmune paleo protocol. But whenever I race, I'm always really careful with things like nuts and seeds and eggs. And then certainly no gluten or dairy, which are really common food allergens. Mm-hmm. And that's why. It's just because the racing is really hard on your gut.
Mm-hmm. And then, so, you know, if someone had maybe a little bit, a meal that maybe is a bit better for them, which is kind of tough a lot of the time when you are in a, you know, a new place and you just want to get something down you. But what would it be okay, say you had a race that finished at, you know, 11 a.m. midday, to then have something that evening, or is that even too soon?
Oh, no. I think, I mean, so each person is going to have to become their own expert.
Okay.
And I'm a big fan of that in general. And really, no one can, like, once you understand these principles, like what's going on with your gut when you do a race or a hard run, then, you know, it's up to you then to figure it out. Like, I can tell you what the common food allergens are, and I already did. It's gluten, dairy, maybe nuts, seeds, eggs, possibly nightshades. Those are the things which are likely to cause anybody trouble. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's up to you to kind of experiment with those things and find out what works and what doesn't. And, you know, no nutritionist, no dietitian could ever, you know, really help you much more than that, because, you know, nobody knows how you feel like you do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, you know, I want to dive into this just a little bit more with, you know, in emails when we were kind of going back and forth, you talked about, we kind of mentioned about orthorexia, and you said, you know, people had called you orthorexic before and you know, you didn't care. And I just, you know, I'm sure a few people out there are listening are thinking like, you know, I don't want to pay attention to all this stuff. Like, this is, you know, why should I, you know, monitor everything I'm eating? But do you want to kind of say something for the other side of that? Maybe if that's what you kind of see it as, you know, the better you look after your body, the better you feel, or what reasons would you say to people to just keep striving to be better?
I mean, you have to consider what your goal is. So for me as a hobby pro mountain biker, I enjoy being competitive, but what I really care about is the business that I've started. Mm-hmm. And I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and it would be nice to have enough energy to play with her once I finish a 3-hour ride. And so those are my priorities, really. And, you know, considering those, I think is, you know, that's the most important thing. And if being orthorexic is what it takes to achieve those goals, I'm okay with that. I don't really give a crap if people think less of me because I don't want to eat in a restaurant, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then I'm very lucky. My wife is, you know, she's seen the benefits for herself too, that she really doesn't do well with dairy at all. It gives her all kinds of skin problems, acne and such, and screws up her hormones and turns into a bit of a monster, and then gives her GI distress as well. So she's, you know, really onto the same program as I am. And we don't want to put my daughter through what I went through as a kid. And so she's basically on the program too. So we put an awful lot of effort into preparing food to take with us whenever we go away. And, you know, when we go away on a bike race, I'm just about to go to Canada for a week of racing, and we're just going to vacuum seal a ton of stuff in bags. You know, like, most people would think that's kind of weird. Like, why would you not just eat in restaurants? And it's because I've not had good results eating in restaurants. Yeah. So I get sick when I eat restaurant food. And so I'm just not going to do that. And I guess the question is, is it me, or is it all of the restaurants? And I have a sneaking suspicion it's all of the restaurants. Yeah. Because there are one or two that I think are survivable. You know, we have one called Mission Heirloom here in the Bay Area, whose sole purpose is to produce food that which is hypoallergenic, right? It doesn't cause people with food sensitivities a ton of problems. And, you know, I've never had an issue eating any of their food, in the same way as I don't have an issue eating the food that we make here at home. So, yeah, I say screw it to orthorexia. You know, like, if it makes you feel good, then what's the problem?
And have you seen any kind of change over the last few years that people maybe are moving a little bit more in the right direction with restaurants? Are you seeing more of those places, or is it as rare as you kind of mentioned right there?
No, it's still, I think we're still a drop in the ocean. You know, I move around in this tiny little bubble where I only talk to people that are basically thinking the same way as I do. And when you step out of that bubble, you know, restaurants just care about making people happy. They don't care about anything else. Like, if the food makes you kind of sick in the long term, or fat or tired or anything else, they don't care about that. They just want to give you pleasure in that moment, in the hope that you'll return again and spend your money. And you know, that's the problem. So they'll use things like industrial seed oils and you know, use cooking techniques that are really not great for your long-term health. Mm-hmm. And they just don't care about that. I mean, it's just a business like any other, right?
Mm-hmm. And then, okay, so let's talk about food a little bit more. So a lot of people listening know that I have made some changes recently, increasing my fat, increasing my protein, kind of moving more towards that paleo style, although kind of a middle ground, just because of the mileage I run and, you know, not quite ready to move over that way. But do you want to kind of share maybe a bit on your thoughts on why it works, and what about what you would like to say to people who think, oh, you know, paleo diet, what does that mean? You know, I don't want to do that.
The paleo diet has been a really good keyword for me to unlock the solution for people. And there's nothing specific. So I don't care that much for the idea that, you know, oh, this is what cavemen ate, and so we should eat that exact same diet. I think that was a hypothesis that people started off with. Mm-hmm. Maybe Lauren Cordain was thinking about this stuff in the 60s, and then it sort of became more popular in the 90s. But the food science has moved on so much further than that, the nutrition science, I should say. And so our understanding of, say, gluten and dairy as food allergens is so much more sophisticated now. And yeah, I just use the paleo as like a template, as a framework. And yeah, it gets great results. I mean, it's the first thing you've got to try. If you're not feeling good, then you've got to start with your diet. And you mentioned the fat, and I think that's been so important. When I first started this, when I was racing as an amateur, I would just pound the maltodextrin, right? I couldn't go more than 40 minutes without taking one of those little gels. Mm-hmm. And then the bottles on my bike would be loaded up with sugar water. And I absolutely had to have that. And I would, you know, in a 3 or 4 hour ride, I consume 1,000 calories of sugar. Whereas now, eating a very high fat diet, low carbohydrate, moderate protein. So that's kind of important, that I'm not eating a ton of protein, just a moderate amount of protein. And that has enabled me to become a fat burning beast, right? I can go 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours without eating anything. I can just drink plain water. And that's just been phenomenal for my gut, you know, not being starving hungry all the time, absolutely have to eat food as soon as I get home, you know, like knocking my kid out the way to get to the refrigerator, has been tremendously helpful for maintaining my gut health. Mm-hmm. And it's also been really good for my endurance performance as well. So I think you're absolutely doing the right thing by changing up your diet to get better results.
And how long would you say most people would need to kind of really give this a go before they notice a difference?
I mean, I started to feel better after 2 weeks.
Okay.
Honestly, I mean, it was, my blood sugar regulation was so terrible. And it was one of the reasons I wasn't sleeping. You know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night starving hungry. I used to get up and eat oatmeal in the middle of the night because I was so hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And now the thought of doing that is just, I mean, it's just completely unthinkable. I go to sleep and I wake up and it's the morning every time, which is just, I mean, it's an emotional experience after you've been an insomniac for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
So, and I know that the blood sugar ratios, it's not the whole story, but the blood sugar regulation is an important part of that. And you have to be able to do, so your body has two states, right? It has the fed state and the fasted state. And when you're sleeping, you're in the fasted state. So you're breaking things down to provide energy for the tissue that's still, the cells are obviously still working, particularly your brain is a very expensive organ to keep running when you're sleeping. And the energy to do that needs to come from somewhere if you're not eating. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you can't do the fasted state, then you're going to wake up. You're going to see a stress response and you're going to wake up. So yeah, the high fat diet has just been truly wonderful for unexpected reasons for me.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great for you. Great for me to hear. And I'm sure other people appreciate listening to that as well. Okay. And then, I wanted to kind of go over the Dutch test, which you actually had me do, a few weeks ago. I know some people were curious about what this was and if you could kind of explain what it is, you know, why it's effective, why it's better than just looking at saliva or blood and, you know, why this is so groundbreaking.
It's super nerdy. I hope I don't lose too many people with some technical words here, but the Dutch is, it's the Dutch stands for dried urine test for comprehensive hormones. And it's a urine test that you do at home. And there are four pieces of filter paper. So it looks like just filter paper you'd use to filter coffee. And you pee onto them. And then you mail them back to the lab at Precision Analytical is the name of the lab that produces the test. And right there, it's kind of cool because the dried filter paper is very light and slim. And you can send it in a regular envelope from anywhere in the world. So if you're listening to this in Hong Kong, there's no problem with you doing this test. It's going to cost you the price of a few postage stamps to send the samples back to the lab. And so that's one clear advantage already over blood and saliva as well. The modern saliva tests, they have to be refrigerated or even frozen and packed on ice and sent. And that makes it very expensive to send those results from, you know, countries other than the US and maybe the UK. So it's super simple to do. You do this test at home. And then at the lab, they use this methodology called mass spectrometry to measure the amounts of urinary metabolites of hormones that are in the sample. So they can measure cortisol, testosterone, progesterone, estrogen, melatonin, which is a sleep hormone, and then metabolites of all those things. And the metabolites are interesting, particularly to me as a nerdy computer programmer, because you can see not just the amount of hormones that you're making, but then also where they're going. And this is important because some of the pathways for the hormones are more desirable than others. And I think this is particularly relevant for people who are taking hormone replacement therapy because some of the pathways are really not good at all. And you want to make sure that the supplemental estrogen or testosterone that you're taking is not headed in one of these undesirable directions. And that's just not possible with a saliva or a blood test. You just don't get that level of detail with those other tests. So blood is great for some things and saliva is pretty decent for some things as well. But I think that the urinary metabolites testing, the Dutch, combines the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And when you said about hormone replacement, is what do you mean by that? Just for anyone listening who may not know what that means.
Oh, sure. So it's really common, especially for perimenopausal women, to be taking supplemental progesterone or estrogen. And, you know, they'll take those as maybe transdermal creams or it's some sort of, I won't go into all the different ways in which you could apply these hormones. But yeah, so they're taking hormones from the outside. So they're exogenous hormones that
rather
are replacing
than a birth control pill.
Birth control pill is another type of hormone replacement therapy, I suppose.
Okay, good to know. And then, so, you know, I did have this test done, as did, I did listen to an episode of Ben Greenfield's podcast a few weeks ago, and he had, you know, it done as well. And both of us, for different reasons, had high cortisol. In, you know, we obviously both had some different numbers for different things, but, you know, you, what kind of things can people expect to figure out from looking at this? And, you know, what is it about cortisol that is different with the Dutch test as opposed to looking at the creatine kinase or just the cortisol level itself within a blood test?
Sure. So I think do most people know, do you think? So cortisol is this stress hormone.
Yeah.
Do you think people know what cortisol is? You get chased by a tiger. Your adrenal glands produce this hormone, cortisol.
Yep.
And cortisol is a fairly slow-acting hormone that catabolizes things. It just causes things to break down. And the reason it does that is because your body's trying to mobilize energy. It's trying to liquidate its assets, right? So if you're being chased by a tiger, it doesn't make any sense to invest in reproduction or digestion or building bigger muscles or any of that stuff. You just want to liquidate your assets, get the heck out of there. And cortisol follows a circadian rhythm. So it's an interesting hormone for athletes to measure. Like, what kind of balance are you in? Are you in a more of a catabolic state where you're breaking things down all the time? Or are you in more of an anabolic state where you're building up and making new muscles and thinking about reproduction and you've got strong sex drive and all of that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so what would make people want to go beyond looking at this in just their... you know, they get their blood work done and it says they have high cortisol. So what would be the benefit beyond that?
Yeah, so with the blood chemistry and also with the saliva test as well, like, you don't really know what's truly going on with cortisol.
Mm-hmm.
So cortisol in blood is bound to a transport protein, right? So cortisol is a steroid hormone and it doesn't mix well in an aqueous solution like the blood. So it needs to take a ride on something, and that ride is a transport protein called cortisol binding globulin. And then I think a little bit travels on albumin as well. So it's just a protein that carries the steroid hormone. And so when you look at cortisol in the blood chemistry, that's the bound part of the hormone. So that's what's being created and then is bound to a transport protein. And that cortisol is not able to act on a cell. It's only the free fraction which is active. And a saliva test measures the free fraction. But the problem with just measuring the free fraction is the free fraction represents just 1% of the total production.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see all kinds of different types of dysfunction, which you cannot see with either a saliva or a blood test. So the main problem with the blood test is you only get one reading, right? Mm-hmm. So you go to the lab first thing in the morning, you get a single cortisol reading. And you don't know what happened to cortisol after that first morning reading, because cortisol is supposed to peak shortly after you get up in the morning and then it declines gradually during the day. And that's a normal circadian rhythm. And we mm-hmm. see lots of problems with people that have disrupted circadian rhythm where the cortisol is high when it should be low and vice versa. And there are lifestyle things you can do to address that.
Mm-hmm.
But then also you see, so you on paper, like if you just looked at the free cortisol, you could make a comparison with you and Ben's result. You know, you both have high free cortisol. But in Ben's case, Ben is making a ton of cortisol. So that means his brain wants it. His brain is sending a message to his adrenal glands. We are under stress. Make a ton of cortisol. Let's just get away from this tiger. Whereas in your case, that's not happening. Like, your brain is asking for a normal amount of cortisol, but you're just not clearing it as well as you should.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are two very distinct cases that you just would never be able to tell the difference between the two with a blood test or a saliva test.
And this is kind of that same thing we were talking about earlier, where, you know, if this is something that you ignore, and, you know, high cortisol is obviously not going to be good for you long term. So, you know, this is one of those situations where the number may not be doing you any damage right now, but it may, you know, give it 10 years or whatever, it may come back to get you. So is this something, am I right in saying that? And is this something that most people should, you know, try to pay a bit more attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a very funny, if anyone's looking for a really good book to better understand cortisol, I couldn't recommend one more highly than Why Zebras, and that's zebras, not zebras, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And that's a book by a neuroscientist called Robert Sapolsky. And I believe it's in that book. There's a very funny Far Side cartoon of an office worker, and he's standing waiting for a train, and he's not wearing any trousers, not pants, trousers. That this is what cortisol does. It one of the things is it actually stops you from forming long-term memories. So it's really interesting, the neuroscience of cortisol. But basically, the cortisol, the stress response, is one of the things that helps you create short-term memories. But in order to turn those short-term memories into long-term memories, cortisol is not helpful for that. So you start to become forgetful. Mm-hmm. And so that might creep up on you over, you know, years or even decades. And then also, you know, we talked about the catabolic nature of hormones. So it breaks down proteins, it slows bone formation. So maybe you end up getting a bunch of stress fractures, which are totally unexplained, right? Like, I don't get it. I'm not overtraining. I've had someone look at my running gait. You know, I know I'm not doing anything wrong. And yet still these stress fractures are happening for unexplained reasons. Well, this could be it. It could be that you have a high level of cortisol, and that's slowing the formation of bone, and so your bones are just weak because of that.
Okay, that's I'm really glad you mentioned that, because I'm sure a lot of people listening probably have been in that situation where, you know, they do keep getting injured, do keep having problems, and they you know, their diet is taken care of, they are looking after themselves. So that is good that you mentioned that, so that, you know, this may be something that you really do consider. And if you care enough about your running and you care enough about your training and your life, then, you know, this is something definitely worth getting, and I would definitely recommend it. I was, you know, it was very easy. You just pee on these strips at certain times throughout the day and send them in. And like Chris said, it was just very simple. So I will put links in the show notes to all of these different tests and some other information about Chris and in the show notes at runnersconnect.net/RC113. And then, so Chris, just some other maybe markers that people might see in their blood chemistry that should be kind of an indicator to, you know, dive a bit deeper into what's going on, maybe consider one of these tests. So we've mentioned cortisol. You've mentioned, I can't remember which other one you mentioned earlier. You mentioned another one. I think it was maybe cholesterol. But what other ones should people pay attention to if they do seem a little off?
Ooh, yeah. So my favorite markers for endurance athletes, you know, glucose, obviously you can do that yourself at home, right? You can go into amazon.com and you can link to this, I guess, in the show notes. Yep. Just if you look on Amazon, you can get a $5 finger stick test where you can test your own blood glucose. You don't need to go to the lab for that. And you're looking really for around 85 or maybe even less for fasting blood glucose. And that's not what we normally see in the athletes that we test. So we normally see some value in the mid 90s or even low hundreds. And I think that's a bit of a red flag that something's going on. Okay. And then you may see like slightly elevated hemoglobin A1C, which should really be, you know, less than 5.5, I would say. And then you can look at fasting insulin. And then high sensitivity C-reactive protein is a really good marker for athletes to look at. But you have to understand that if you do a hard workout, then that's going to temporarily raise the level of inflammation. That's sort of the point of the testing, or sorry, of the workout. And then you can look at some of the liver markers like AST and ALT and GGT. If you're a master's athlete, a male master's athlete, you absolutely must get a full iron panel done, I think. So look at so many of the master's athletes that we test are iron overloaded. So you've got to look at ferritin, TIBC, percentage transferrin saturation.
To make sure it's not too high.
Yeah, so okay. The male master's athletes tend to be iron overloaded, and that's a problem. Mm. So that's a really good panel just for the men to do.
Okay.
And then for the women, it could be a possible cause of anemia, but it's we don't see much of that,
okay.
Which may just be the type of people that we work with, or it, you know, I'm not really sure. But yeah, so those are some of the markers that I would look for.
Okay, great. That's very helpful. And actually, for anyone listening right now, I will put a link in the show notes to an interview I did about iron specifically. It was focused on iron with Dr. Pamela Hinton, which is episode number 77. So I'll put that in the show notes. Okay, and then we're just kind of going to wrap up here in a minute. But I wanted to go over, maybe if you could give us a few details about your podcast. You mentioned it at the beginning of the episode. But what kind of guests do you have? You know, what do you talk about for anyone who may not have heard of it? And what is it called?
It's the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that opportunity. Mm-hmm. One of my regular guests is Tommy Wood. So Tommy Wood is a medical doctor. He's just finishing up his PhD. His thesis is work related to neonatal neuroprotection. So Tommy is one of the most talented biochemists I've ever met. And he can look at the organic acids test and see things that I don't think anybody else on the planet can see. Like, he's a truly amazing guy. And he is astonishing at understanding mechanisms. So we talk a lot on the podcast about biochemistry and kind of nerdy stuff and mechanisms that I really enjoy. So he's a regular guest. And then I just get people on that I think have part of the solution. I think it's fun to just interview people that have devoted their life to, you know, just trying to understand one thing. So Mark Newman's a really good example. Mark Newman is the analytical chemist that developed the Dutch test that we've been talking about. And his knowledge is self-described as an inch wide and a mile deep, right? There's nothing he doesn't know about hormones and testing hormones. And he's been on my podcast. So that's what I do. I track people down and, you know, I persuade them to come and give me an hour of my time, their time for nothing, which is phenomenal.
And is it for anyone listening right now who, you know, a lot of what we talked about today may, well, not a lot of it, but some of the stuff we talked about may have been a bit like, whoa, that's a lot of science there. Or is it, do you kind of keep it somewhat sciencey or is it lighthearted? I'm just wondering if this is the true running nerds or if this is people who are kind of just about general running.
Yeah, it's pretty geeky. It's all pretty geeky, I have to say. Like, if you're listening to this and you're an engineer of some sort, then you'll enjoy it. And I do talk to, so last week I interviewed Carl Kingsbury, who's a UFC fighter.
Okay.
And he just talked about what's been working for him, you know, in terms of his diet and his training strategy and some of the supplements he's been taking. And I think it's fun to kind of to explore that too. But yeah, for the most part, it's pretty nerdy.
Okay. I'm going to send my dad that way. He's a manufacturing engineer, so he can go listen to it.
they love it. You know, they do some testing and you give them their results and they come back in 3 weeks' time and they tell you something about themselves or about the testing in general that you didn't know. Like, people are smart and I really enjoy that part of the process.
Yeah, that's cool. And I like looking at it from that kind of way of, I don't know, I guess just that angle. My husband is, he's a coach, a running coach, a cross-country and track coach, but he, his degree is in automotive engineering. So he sees the running training philosophy as very like just engineer, you know, focused, very like, okay, this works with this. And he sees it as like a car and he always uses that as his analogy.
Just a problem solver.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Okay, so we're just going to take a moment to thank our sponsor and then we will be back with the final kick round.
Depending on where you are in the world, summer or winter is coming. We only have a few precious weeks of this ideal running weather before the mental battles begin. Music or podcasts can make those long training days much easier, and I love to listen to 90s music to get me through the really tough parts. Jabra Pulse is the wireless sports earbud that was designed with runners in mind. Yes, that means no slipping out of your ear on those hot summer days, especially with the customizable in-ear pieces. It even has an accurate in-ear heart rate monitor, so you can use that to make sure those easy days stay easy. Yeah, just like you promised. I love mine, and I've run with music or podcasts more in these past few months than I have in the rest of my life combined. That is how great these are. Runners Connect listeners can get exclusive offers and enter to win a free Jabra Pulse headset by signing up at jabra.com/runnersconnect. That's jabra.com/runnersconnect to start your journey, or buy the Jabra Pulse at your local Best Buy. Jabra, this is where it starts.
Okay, and I just have a few more questions for you, Chris, starting with what the greatest advice you've ever received is.
Slow down. That is I did a expletive in there, but I won't say that on air. And that is the greatest advice I ever received, was thinking, you know, I thought that I needed to go as fast as possible to get faster, and or even worse, being in that gray zone, right? So what is this? Like, ask yourself when you get to the end of a run, what was that? Was it a hard run or was it an easy run? Or was it just 2 hours in the gray zone, right? I'm not sure. Like, spending too much time in that gray zone that's neither hard nor easy is a really great strategy for getting faster. So the first time someone came along to me and said, hey, you need to slow down and build this aerobic system. And then, you know, that was certainly the best piece of advice I've ever had.
I'm glad to hear that, because at Runners Connect, we're always preaching about taking your easy days easier. And, you know, we're all about that. And people are always shocked by just how much slower I actually run my recovery runs. So Everyone does it, and it is the way to succeed. So that's good advice.
Go easy on your easy days, and then go hard on your hard days. Yep. Right. So when you do go hard, like, you really give it 100% and not some half-assed, I could only do 3 of the 6 intervals.
Yep. No, absolutely. Great advice. Okay, what is your favorite running book or blog? Maybe you already mentioned that.
Phil Maffetone, I would say. Yeah, okay. Phil Maffetone is the father of all of this. And mm-hmm. Phil Maffetone has been talking about high-fat diets and the MAF method, which is, you know, a way of getting faster without doing a ton of intervals, mm-hmm. since the 1970s. And the Endurance Handbook on Amazon.com is the book I wish I had 15 years ago. And, you know, his work is so important. You're now starting to see people like Mark Sisson build on top of that and release excellent books like Endurance, I think it is.
Okay. Well, I'll put a link to it.
Yeah, Primal Endurance. And he cites Phil all the way through that book, right? So it's like kind of so important that people are building books on top of that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And we have actually interviewed Phil Maffetone, so I'll put a link to that as well.
That one.
Yeah, I have. It wasn't with me. It was with our previous host, but it's still on there. What would you like to tell a new runner? Maybe you already said it.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, I thought about this and I wouldn't know what to say to a new runner because, you know, I'm a mountain biker.
Yeah. Okay, what would you say to a new endurance athlete?
Yeah, to a new endurance athlete, I would say that, you know, understand what this is for. This is not to get skinny. It's not to just about winning races. Like, I think you should have intrinsic desire mm-hmm. in order to run or to bike. And when you notice that intrinsic desire go away, stop, slow down, stop. take 2 months off and see what happens, right? Don't keep plodding on towards some goal that you don't really care about, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just madness to say you've got a race. Say you've already signed up for a race in 3 months' time. Like, do you really care about that result? Like, really, really, do you care about it? Like, a week after the race has happened, will you think about that result ever again? Probably not. So why are you going to let this one thing dictate your whole life for the next 3 months? That mm-hmm. just doesn't make any sense. So the desire to train, it has to be intrinsic.
I think that's important. And it doesn't necessarily have to start as intrinsic. I mean, a lot of people, I always use my sister as an example because she started running to lose weight, but she's kind of realized how it helps her relieve stress and it helps her feel good about herself. And so, you know, you may start as, you know, to lose weight or to, you know, look good in a bikini or whatever it may be. But those things can develop. So give it some time as well.
Yeah, but I would argue with that. So,
oh, really?
You know, yeah, I think, you know, the optimum strategy, I think, for losing weight is walking mm-hmm. and lifting heavy things. Mm-hmm. And so if you're running, I think you should run because you love running. And that's fine. Like, a lot of people love running. But I don't think it's a really great strategy for losing weight. I really don't.
Mm. Interesting. But I mean, I guess I can definitely see where you're coming from. And the weightlifting does make a huge difference, especially, you know, a lot of us don't realize that at first, but it does blast the fat away. And I've really noticed that myself, that I've definitely leaned down since I've started adding more of the strength training in. So
right. I mean, just go to your local half marathon mm-hmm. and have a look at the body composition of the, you know, 1,000, 10,000 even people mm-hmm. doing that type of event. And they're not particularly lean individuals, right? So something's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good point. Thank you. All right. What would be your pre-bike meal?
Yeah, pre-bike meal. Mm-hmm. You know what? I don't even worry about this stuff too much. You know, people worry about, oh, do I need to be eating something to replenish my glycogen or any of that stuff before a race? And because I'm running on fat, you know, I already have that fat on board. It's stored. I have 40,000 plus, 60,000 plus calories of fat already stored. So, you know, what I eat immediately before a race, it really doesn't matter.
So what would be your favorite thing then? What do you enjoy eating something?
Yeah, so I tend to go for things like bone broth and vegetables, and I tend to eat just, you know, whatever meat is left over from the night before, that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
Okay.
So I kind of keep it low on the potential food allergens like eggs and nuts, and certainly no gluten or dairy, which cause me, you know, lots of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's as important as people think.
Okay. Yep. That's good to know. Thank you for bringing that up. It's definitely a different way of looking at things, but I hope that most people feel they can get to that point if you have taken on what Chris said today. And then finally, your favorite maybe endurance product, running product, if you know of any.
My favorite thing is anything that enables you to look inside of your body.
Okay.
Right? So people, and then cyclists are the worst for this. I think runners are actually not as bad, but
mm-hmm.
people love to equipment masturbate, right? They love their Garmin watches, and they love their heart rate straps, and they love their fancy shoes, and cyclists love their bikes and carbon fiber wheels and derailleurs and all of that crap. And I can guarantee that none of that will make you as fast as looking inside of your body.
Hmm.
So the tools that enable you to look inside of your body are the tests that we've talked about, the organic acids, yep. blood chemistry, stool tests, all those things. If you do that type of testing and you find problems, you fix them, that's going to make you feel good. It's going to make you run faster. And I'm not sure I could say that about any of that other junk, right? Like, give me a set of carbon fiber wheels and I will enjoy them and use them and appreciate them. But I don't think they're going to make me any faster. Not like getting rid of yeast overgrowth will.
Yeah, I love that. And what a unique way of looking at it, but so very true. So thank you so much, Chris. And I appreciate your time. And I'm sure everyone's got a lot out of this today. So thank you. And I will encourage everyone to check out more at Nourish, Balance, Thrive.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And there you have it. I know there was a lot of information there, but if you have a health issues, you feel exhausted all the time, or just keep getting injured, this really might be the key. So make sure you check out Chris's podcast or the Nourish Balance Thrive website. I know a lot of you love this nerdy, sciencey stuff. Don't worry, that's me too. Next week, we're going to be talking to 800-meter professional runner Phoebe Wright. But before you start getting intimidated and think she's going to talk about how amazing she is and how easy it is to run, just stop right there. This girl is awesome and she's very relatable. I know you're going to love her and she's just got such a fun sense of humor. So make sure you tune in next Wednesday. And actually, speaking of next Wednesday, this would be a great time to hit the subscribe button so these episodes come right to your phone or your podcast player without you having to go search for them. So until then, have a great week.